Welcome to episode 6 of the Serious About Security podcast for Friday, April 27, 2012, brought to you by the Greater Lafayette Security Professionals Group and the Center for Education and Research in Information Assurance and Security, or SIRIUS, at Purdue University. Let me introduce the host of today's podcast. I'm Preston Wiley, CISSP, CCNA.
This is Keith Watson, Research Engineer at SIRIUS.
George Bailey, CISSP.
And GCIH.
And this is Mike Hill, CISSP.
So for announcements today, we wanted to talk about the SIRIUS Security Seminar. It has reached the end for this semester, and we'll announce the schedule for the fall semester seminar speakers in future podcasts. But if you still want to get some more of that content, you can always go and watch previous seminars. Those are available at the SIRIUS website under the Seminar tab. Just look for the seminar archive link or just search for content. Summaries from the SIRIUS Annual Security Research Symposium have also been posted. You can find summaries to the various panels and keynotes available at the SIRIUS blog at www.cerias.purdue.edu/site/blog.
The next Greater Lafayette Security Professionals Monthly Meeting will be on May 10th. We have not yet decided on its topic for this meeting, so please contact Preston or Keith if you have any ideas for a meeting topic or are willing to present.
And in news, Firefox 12 was released on April 24th. This fix provided 7 critical and 4 high-ranked vulnerability fixes. It also includes a improved updater that can update Firefox in the background without user interaction, similar to the way Chrome updates. You basically have to accept a administrative access right setting for Firefox, and it'll update it from then on without any user interaction. Thunderbird 12 was also released on the same day, and it fixed 13 security vulnerabilities, 6 critical and 4 high-ranked, and I'm not 100% sure, but I'm guessing they included the improved updater with Thunderbird as well. Also, people might want to consider using the extended support release for Firefox and Thunderbird. These are updated less frequently to major version numbers, but they do provide security updates and fixes for these versions, and they're probably more acceptable for enterprise systems where you don't want to be updating your Firefox and Thunderbird to major version numbers every week or so.
It seems like every week, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And one more news item. Microsoft patched a zero-day flaw in their Hotmail system on the 20th of April. This flaw allowed anyone to reset anybody else's password because they didn't properly check the token for resetting the password. So people who do have a Hotmail account and haven't logged in since the 20th are advised to log into their account to make sure that their password is still what they think it is, and if it has been compromised, then you probably want to take some other actions on your other accounts. If you use that email address for your password reset emails for other accounts. And that is the news.
So for articles for this podcast, the first one we wanted to talk about is the Iranian oil terminal is now offline after a malware attack. I found this one to be interesting because the Iranian National Oil Company and the oil ministry were targets of this attack, which has been reported as a virus of some sort. The oil terminal is on an island which is 16 miles off the coast of Iran. It's an area where they can take large tankers, park them off a pier, and basically fill them up right there. And this system apparently has been disconnected manually, I believe, from the internet. Why it's on the internet, not quite sure, but disconnected due to a malware attack. And the websites for the National Oil Company and the Oil Ministry site were down for a while. I believe they might both be back up at the moment. But the interesting thing is this follows on the heels of 2 years ago with the Stuxnet worm, which actually targeted their nuclear program and damaged the centrifuges used in processing uranium ore. And so we have to wonder, is this virus attack something similar to Stuxnet with a little broader mission where they're not exactly targeting individual logic controllers in this case, but actually a more general attack targeting the oil industry and the oil systems. So some of the fallout from this was interesting because the president of Iran was asked to look into creating what they called a Supreme Council of Cyberspace. And they also have a cyber crisis committee to handle aftermath of this attack and to kind of see what they can do to bolster some of their defenses to prevent this in the future. I believe the cyber crisis committee was formed after the Stuxnet problem, but apparently they are now, it seems to be a committee-driven country where you have a supreme council of this or that, and you have a crisis committee for this or that. So they seem to be very committee-driven. I don't know how well that'll work in this case. But anyways, the interesting thing was, is there a government agency behind this attack trying to impede oil production from Iran, which is the second largest OPEC-producing nation? I don't know. We don't have any evidence yet. It'd be interesting to see how this plays out. It could be that their systems are just that vulnerable. Due to sanctions, they are not able to get access to security products or tools that may have prevented these types of attacks. There's a lot of question marks here and not a lot in the news. We have a link here for the FARS News service, which is really part of the Iranian government or at least a mouthpiece for it. And they did not have a lot to say about it other than like, oh, yeah, we're working on it. We're cleaning this up. Nothing to see here. Move on. But it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. But my questions are, is this a targeted attack similar to what happened with the Stuxnet worm? Or is it a question of they didn't have the right security tools such as antivirus, anti-malware type devices and software due to embargoes placed on this country that led to this issue? It'd be very interesting to see how that played out.
Well, reading the article led me to the impression that I didn't necessarily get the impression that this was a targeted attack. I see where it could be, but it seems like it's more of the latter, that they didn't have the appropriate tools in place to kind of prevent this malware. And I also wonder how much of the system was exposed to the internet that didn't need to be in this case. I know that they said in the article that there were some other systems that were not affected because they were disconnected. So it seems like they were at least taking some kind of approach to kind of help split off what they deemed highly critical versus, I guess, less critical. But another thing I saw in the article that kind of led me to worry is that Iran's Revolutionary Guard claimed to have created a hack-proof network for all of its sensitive data. And I guess as a security professional, hack-proof really makes me worry because I've yet to see anything that's entirely hack-proof. There's certainly layers of defense you can add, but to actually claim that it's unbreakable, that almost seems like taunting someone to say, go ahead and try.
Yeah, that's always a call to arms for various activists who may want to just test out how hack-proof something is. We can always talk about Oracle's unbreakable marketing campaign from a decade ago as an example of, you may not want to talk about that too much.
Well, I read these articles and there's really not any information in these articles to determine where the attack came from, what happened or anything like that. I mean, I think if this is a targeted attack, then we'll probably hear more about it in a month or so. But if it's probably just a virus, it'll probably just kind of disappear into into the realm.
I wonder if it could have been started by a phishing email or something like that. We always talk about that in the security community as being one way in which you get malicious software into a highly protected, you know, crunchy on the outside type organization, is if you can fool enough employees to click on bad links that bring malware into your environment. I wonder if this is a case of that. It would be interesting to see. Although, you know, this being Iranian government and not exactly friends with the United States and probably won't be for a long time, we probably will never know. But it is interesting. Especially interesting in the heels of Stuxnet and when we did our first or second podcast and we talked about the 60 Minutes episode, and U.S. intelligence folks were basically claiming that this is a great idea. We should be doing this more often. If this were a targeted attack by a foreign government, it would be interesting to see what happens after this. I mean, certainly we're all concerned about other countries with less resources attempting to build their own cyber attack services in some way to probe and possibly disable the infrastructure of foreign governments. This might be minor skirmishes on the way to a larger war or something like that. So stay tuned.
Okay, well, the next article is about a backdoor in some mission critical hardware. The story behind this is about a year ago, a security researcher discovered a vulnerability in the what they call the Rugged OS, which is a system that runs on traffic control devices, railway systems, and some other highly critical infrastructure, and reported it to the company. I think it's a Canadian company that produces this operating system, and they basically got a cold shoulder, and the company didn't want to respond. So they submitted this to CERT, and a year later they published this vulnerability publicly, and the vendor isn't going to fix it, and really has it. I'm not even sure if they really can fix it. I'm not sure. But it's a very simple vulnerability in that basically there was a built-in account on the system with a fairly easy to guess password that based on the MAC address of the device. And I think one of the more interesting things about that is when you start to log into the device actually tells you what the MAC address is of the device, so that it makes this vulnerability just that much easier to exploit. Now this is obviously there's security measures that can be taken to mitigate this. You know, putting your systems behind security devices and things like that. But still, this creates what they've termed as a forever day vulnerability. Basically, this is a vulnerability that's going to exist in these systems forever because the manufacturer I don't think has the ability to fix them. I'm not sure if they could release a firmware update, but I mean, updating traffic control systems and railway systems and things like that isn't the easiest thing to do. So I just wanted to know what everyone else thought about this.
I found it interesting that that they would have these systems on the internet. So to make them vulnerable, I mean, they're certainly vulnerable with this default account, and the password is easily predictable. You shell into these things, and the first thing it gives you is the version of the OS and the build and the MAC address. So there's posted Perl scripts out there that make the enumeration of the password very simple. But why, I guess my question would be, why are organizations putting these on anything other than a closed network? And I don't know if there's a need for that. Do these things have to be on the internet? So yes, it is vulnerable. They're very much exposed, but are they exposed to the world? So is this a very big deal, or is this, it's bad practice and it's certainly a bad design, but how many systems are truly in danger? Any idea?
I don't know if we know numbers of systems, but part of the problem is that I think in this case, if you read through some of the information, it indicated that while these services or while these devices had a SSH as well as a web interface, those interfaces did not accept the default username and password, the login of factory. But it was accessible over Telnet. So then the question becomes, in my mind, is this something that somebody would have known was there? Is it documented anywhere? Is it a user account that was put in during development but never removed before shipment? We've seen cases of that before. Now, regardless, that the fact that it's there is bad. That's clearly a problem. And if it were there for a particular reason, it should be at least be something you could turn off. Unfortunately, the manufacturer did not do that. So that's problem one, right? Bad practice on the vendor side. The other problem is that some of these devices exist in the middle of nowhere, for example. They might be controlling power switching, transmission substation somewhere in the middle of nowhere. There's no, a company official may come and visit this faraway place once a month, if that. So most of the monitoring is done using these devices. Well, how do you bring internet to a thing like that out in the field? Well, if you can get DSL or broadband, you might go that route. And then if you look at the example image in the article, it seems to be that, because the URL is comcastbusiness.net. So these devices are out there. They may have a simple cable modem connecting them up to the network. It might be DSL. It might be satellite. We don't know. But if they had taken and connected this up to a cable modem and said, well, we'll open SSH access because we've locked that down. We only have limited access. We're using public key encryption. We have the right key on there. That's okay. Web interface, that's a little more questionable. But those devices exist out there for them to query and control remotely. But they could have taken other steps to prevent other network services from getting through that cable modem onto this device. Still allow them to have a remotely managed substation device out in the field, still connected to the internet over something, but they could have locked it down a little better. And so, yeah, there are some difficulties in trying to monitor systems way out in the field somewhere at a low cost. And I think this is a cost issue, right? How do I manage a system without building or digging a fiber out to it and laying fiber 60 miles out in the desert when I can get satellite internet access or I could get cable modem access? But even if you're going to do that, there's still some basic security things you should be doing. And apparently that did not happen here. So it's a problem on two sides. One, it's the vendor not doing the right thing, at least not giving you the capability to disable these features. The other being that whoever deployed it didn't know enough about the product or didn't take the basic steps that we would expect somebody to take to prevent unauthorized access to that device.
Yeah, I think you make some very interesting points about that. What I found the most disturbing was that, Preston brought this article, and I actually went over to his office after I read it and I said, did I read that right? Did I read that they access these devices over Telnet through the internet? Clearly, that's not a good security design. And I do have to wonder whether that account was put in there for kind of internal testing, kind of where you would, within your local area network, maybe you could have a trusted telnet access, but certainly not make it available and open through the internet. That's just, boy, that's scary to think that, especially considering what these devices control. So, you know, I guess the question now is, what can they do to kind of fix this? You know, hopefully they are, since this is not something they can disable in firmware, hopefully they're at least able maybe to shut down the telnet ports and not allow that traffic to flow through, at least kind of close some of these gaps and not make it nearly as vulnerable.
Well, keep in mind also that some of these devices out there are managed through an automated system, and sometimes that automated system was written 12 years ago when telnet was the main method by getting access to these devices, and it basically would log in, issue some interactive commands, gather the output, and then close the connection. So it's not just a matter of turning it off, it's more of like rewriting 10-year-old code, 12-year, 20-year-old code to go and actually gather data in a different way. And it's going to take an investment on the side of these infrastructure organizations to say, hey, what we did was probably not the right approach, and we need to figure out how to fix it. And it's going to take them some money to do it, I think. And that's probably the big hang up right now.
Yeah. Well, and as a software developer, I say that's what should be taking place. You know, working on a system I wrote 2 years ago, as I enhance it, it's like there's new threats today that weren't there even 2 years ago. You go back 10 years, wow. Yeah, there's a lot of different techniques available today to exploit that. So I guess that's my, my impression is any new deployment, and I'm looking at the screenshot here, 2008, you know, and it looks like an update around 2010, because this nice little interface, even before you log in, gives you all this nice detail about the system. You know, at that point in time, they should have been taking the appropriate precautions. And as of 2008, I think opening up Telnet is a bad idea.
And it's probably beating a dead horse here, but obviously application security is key here, because one of the things, formerly working as in the OS industry, for the longest time, we sold OSs that when you install them, they had every service enabled automatically by default. And we wrote documentation telling customers how to turn it all off. And it wasn't until we got to later releases that we actually changed that mindset and started shipping operating systems with everything turned off by default. This is probably a similar case of that. These embedded system developers are providing every service available and requiring the customer to figure out how to turn it off. And while we've done that in the OS space, we've moved from a everything on to an everything off model, I don't know that the embedded system developers have thought that through yet. And even if they have, there's a challenge there, because if you're dealing with an embedded system, it's not as easily configured in some cases as your operating system is. And so some of it is due to the challenges of the infrastructure environment, where you've got these remote devices and you got to manage them somehow, but also a challenge in you have this remote device that's not as easy to configure as an operating system. How do you get that in the field quickly, get it set up and set up securely? And I think that's where we are in terms of challenges for an industry. We kind of dealt with that somewhat in the software industry. We're not perfect, certainly. But the embedded guys now have to learn similar lessons, if you will.
Yeah, and I'll just comment on that with the embedded systems. I actually worked with embedded systems up till about 2005. And fortunately, during my time, none of those devices were being hooked up to the internet. So it's a paradigm shift, and they've got to consider the consequences of that. Because as soon as you plug it into the internet, we all know all the bad stuff just running on that pipeline, that your closed software is now immediately available too. So hopefully this will be an example of, you know, beginning to make that shift. These are things that have to be considered, especially for mission critical hardware such as this.
Especially the fact that we're talking about forever day bugs. The name alone tells you what kind of significance this problem brings.
Okay, we'll move on to the next article, and this one is George's.
Well, this article is much different than the ones we've previously discussed. This one doesn't have to necessarily do with technology. It's really an improper use of technology. This article has to do with a small cardiac surgery practice in Phoenix being fined $100,000 for HIPAA violations. I choose this article because this is the year that the OCR, the Office of Civil Rights, are conducting 150 audits of healthcare providers and covered entities because HIPAA has been very poorly enforced in the last decade. Well, the reason this article is interesting to me is because this is a practice that's owned by two physicians. They have five medical providers, so it's a very small medical practice, and they settled for $100,000. And what did they do wrong? Well, they were posting patient appointments and related information to an internet-based calendar for in conjunction with their electronic medical record. Great for efficiency, great for productivity, possibly great for internal information sharing within, you know, authorized persons of the practice to know, but they didn't secure it properly. They didn't even know to think about securing it properly. So I definitely like to hear some commentary about, you know, is in your opinion, gentlemen, HIPAA a burden? Do you feel that it's absolutely necessary as a privacy control, security control in this day and age with all kinds of other regulation and state privacy laws as and to the extent that they are? And do you think that small providers should be treated the same as large providers, say a hospital system or a major medical system?
Well, I'm not sure that size makes a difference in terms of responsibility. Even though this is a small clinic, and I'm looking through the resolution agreement currently to see how many people were affected, but I believe it was several thousand, if I'm correct. I don't see the numbers right offhand. So even though they're a small five-doc practice, they still had several thousand patients. And all of that information was at risk. So to say that, oh, well, they're the small guys, they don't need to protect as much as the big guys do, I think they still have a responsibility to protect patient information. I think that if you look at the HIPAA security rule, there are a couple things that seem geared for large practices. And so maybe the law, which tries to be a one-size-fits-all solution, to address this, maybe the solution that should be considered is different tiers for protection requirements. And there are some things that you read through in there which only apply to very large organizations. And we've seen some very small organizations that were really challenged to meet these requirements. And maybe that's the requirements that need to change, not the responsibility. They're still responsible for protecting patient health information, but maybe they're responsible to protect it in different ways from the larger organizations. And I don't have a solution. I have not written my mini HIPAA law yet, so I don't know what that is, but that's something that we may want to consider, because we do go into some of these smaller places and say, well, I know you don't do this, and maybe that's not really applicable to your situation, but it is in the law and you do have to follow it. Maybe there's a mini HIPAA version that does not discount the responsibility of a provider to protect, but changes the protection requirements in a way that is more applicable to their situation. Now, we could also argue between required and addressable, but that's a different challenge, because even an addressable requirement is still something that has to be done. Just the way you do it is applicable uniquely in each situation.
Well, what I find a bit alarming about it is you said they shared the information of the calendar and they didn't really even think about it. And maybe this is an example of small practices really need to start taking HIPAA very seriously. And I even think of I've been to a smaller doctor's office in the last year or so, and I remember the physician was complaining about switching over to electronic records and what a hassle it was. And, you know, I was kind of biting my tongue a little bit because it's kind of like, shouldn't you have an IT consultant or an IT security consultant kind of be available to you? And I'm not faulting the doctor in this case, but it seems like there should be a roadmap for the physicians, especially the smaller practices, to follow that say, you can't really do HIPAA on your own. There's a lot of components to it. You should get a consultant in here and at least get things set up and protect yourself because, you know, physicians are experts in the medical field. You know, they're overwhelmed with that. Taking on IT security on top of that, I think is asking a lot. So, you know, I kind of come at it from the angle of, you know, I know that they were hit with this, and I think it's probably good that they're hit with a fine so that others will take it seriously. But where's, you know, is there a roadmap that they can follow so that they know, you know, whether or not they're in compliance with this act, because it's an important one to be in compliance with.
There absolutely is, I won't call it a roadmap, but there are initiatives, there's guidance, there's, right, HIPAA's been around since 96 and 2003, respectively, between the privacy and the security rules. So it's old hat, right? It's been around for over a decade. There's been some high-level audits. There's been some major fines ranging from, you know, this $100,000 settlement to just recently Blue Cross Blue Shield saw a $1.5 million fine for lost hard drives. So it's very newsworthy. It's out there. Providers are getting the gist that, you know, this is serious, right? It's the right thing to do for patient privacy, right? We should be doing it regardless if there was legislation telling us we had to. And they truly understand the intent of HIPAA. But you're right, they don't understand the security aspect of HIPAA. A lot of providers are very good at maintaining the privacy practices, right? They understand HIPAA privacy rule. They seem to do a very good job of training their staff and maintaining the confidentiality, right? They got good shredding practices and data sharing with their business associates and contractual controls in place. But when it comes to firewalls and networks and wireless security, you are dead on, Mike. They need someone. And in many cases, the practices that I've visited, it's a friend of a family. It's a former patient. It's someone that they know that they have an intimate relationship with that is savvy, but by all means is not an IT professional and certainly not a security practitioner. And right now with the meaningful use federal funding, right, every primary care physician in the country going to electronic medical record is eligible for serious incentives, $18,000 to $25,000, by showing that they're using their EHR meaningfully. And part of that is to have a security risk assessment. You can't get the federal funds without having your practice assessed. You can do it internally. You know, you can do a self-assessment if you could document. But then there are many organizations that provide security assessment services for those practices. And
you know, the other thing I've noticed is when you go into some organizations, one of the questions I always ask during interviews are, what's the culture like? Does the organization have a culture of protecting patient information? And for the most part, the ones I've interviewed so far, they seem to do that. They have confidentiality agreements that they require all their employees to sign. They do annual HIPAA training to remind them how to protect stuff. They may even have posters up in break rooms to remind them, you know, that this is important. Some of them have meetings and they set expectations. Here's what you have to do for protecting patient health information. It seems to me that perhaps the Phoenix organization didn't have that kind of culture. So I think if they had, they would have, as their resolution agreement says, spent more time training employees and verifying that they understood HIPAA and were compliant with it They would have asked a few more questions about, really, should we post this information on an internet-based service? And they would have at least done a little better job in protecting patient health information. I'm not sure the culture at this organization, and I don't know anything about it other than what we've read so far, whether the culture had anything to do with it or not, which is not really a technical problem, but I find it interesting because organizations that at least have that culture sometimes know they are not doing the right things and want to improve.
Well, one other comment is I also don't think these companies who aren't thinking about security realize that if you build in security at the beginning, it's a lot cheaper than tacking it on at the end. I mean, you mentioned the Blue Cross incident of the $1.5 million fine. Well, according to this article, they also incurred $17 million in direct expenses related to the HIPAA violations in remediation and investigation. So, I mean, that's a huge number. So I think kind of these breaches and these high fines kind of maybe will open some eyes and they'll realize how much money they could cost them if they don't do this and something does happen. I mean, with that one office, $100,000 was the fine, but how much did it cost them to, implement the security that they needed to put in the first place?
And they also had a time limit. I think they had 30 days to basically mediate a lot of these issues and correct the issues. 30 days is not a lot of time to do that in. So who knows what their budget is to bring in outside experts to help them get there in 30 days. I don't know.
Okay, we'll go on to the last article, which is Mike's.
Yes, the article I brought for today is the one from Sophos. It's 1 in 5 Macs has malware on it. Does yours? And I brought this article up because in the last podcast or the podcast before that, we were talking about the flashback malware on Macs and how vulnerable Macs really are. So this article that came out said that 1 in every 5 Mac computers has some kind of malware on it. But it goes on further to say that that 20%, that 1 in 5, is actually carrying Windows malware on a Mac, which for a Mac computer means it's really not executing, but that makes the computer a carrier. So if you're sharing a flash drive with someone who has a Windows machine, you may be inadvertently passing along something, but your operating system is secure from it. Now, another statistic was they were able to determine that out of those, and this was about 100,000 snapshot that they took out of the millions of Macs that are out there. Another statistic is that about close to 3%, 2.7%, or 1 in every 36 Macs has Mac malware on it. And the majority of those were the flashback. So I just wanted to kind of bring this article forth today because we've been, over the last couple podcasts, we've kind of been bounced around a little bit on Apple's position on malware. And we kind of talked about how there was a bit of a slow response to the flashback. And I think some recommendations were, well, for the majority of things, you don't even need Java. And if you had Java disabled or not even installed on your Mac, then you wouldn't have been vulnerable to it. This article kind of struck me as, obviously Sophos is clamoring for their antivirus tool and saying Mac users should have this installed. And if they had antivirus program running, then, a lot of these things would not, it would take care of this malware. And that's kind of where I wanted to take the conversation, because I've been in kind of circles where there's been a strong argument for running antivirus on Macs, and there's been a strong argument against running it. And I will admit I have a MacBook for work, which I run antivirus on because of our policy. But we also have a Mac at home that I do not run antivirus on because I feel like it's not really necessary, at least up to this point in time. So I really wanted to kind of address, the current state, because if you see an article like this, it's kind of saying, oh no, you know, 20% of Macs have malware. You know, what's the reality in this case?
I thought what was interesting is, first, yes, it is an article from an antivirus vendor, so we always have to take their what they say is with a grain of salt. But they talk about Macs having Windows malware. I know I have Windows malware because I get it over email. And I have my antivirus thing flag stuff in my email folders all the time saying, hey, there's a Windows virus there. And I'm like, yeah, so? Because we get those. I mean, spam, a lot of spam has attachments that's malicious. That's how they typically show up on a lot of systems. It's through email. If you're downloading something, well, that might be another way. But the fact that you have a Windows virus in your email folder is A, not, you know, too surprising, and B, doesn't mean a whole lot. Unless I'm forwarding that mail onto another Windows user, it's just going to sit there. It's going to get deleted eventually, or my antivirus thing will flag it and quarantine it, and you know, it's no big deal. So they're a little, they're trying to generate a lot of fear here with some of these statements about 20% of Macs carrying Windows malware. Well, yeah. That happens. It's over email. You know, we're going to get those. So I wasn't too worried about that one because I know I do. I see it every once in a while. I see a notice from my malware stuff saying, hey, you've got a Windows virus. Okay. I think what's more interesting is another article, which we're not specifically talking about, but that one's based on Python. And it's a Python scripts. Python runs on a lot of things. Can run on Windows, it can run on Mac, it's included, the interpreter, Python interpreter is included with a Mac, part of the operating system. That's a little more interesting attack, but so we'll see where that one goes. But yeah, they seem to be touting a lot of issues here. Yes, certainly Macs do have problems. They are not immune to malicious software. There's just less of it right now. Hopefully everybody has applied the 3 patches required from Apple to correct the Java problem, which was the way in which this thing got onto a system. But this article seemed a little to hype up this issue more than perhaps it needed to.
Yeah, and regarding the Python-based malware, because I did see that one come through earlier today, it's actually exploiting the Java security vulnerability. So, and really, for the article with the Macs with malware, what I looked at, I didn't focus on the 20% with Windows malware because, as you said, okay, it's not directly impacting my environment. I'm not going to be worried about that. But it said 2.7% or one in every 36 Macs does have Mac malware on it. And then they had a nice little chart. 75% of the Macs that fell into that category, it was because of the Java vulnerability, which means they were Macs that had not been patched and not been updated to the latest version to correct that. So, you know, if you eliminate all those statistics, it's a really small number that they're saying has Mac malware on it. So, you know, it's kind of like, well, you know, one of the things I didn't necessarily agree with the article, or, as you said, it's an antivirus company, but it was almost kind of saying, you know, Macs are just as vulnerable as Windows, or kind of implying it. And I don't feel that yet. I'm not saying it can't ever become that way, but I think in the current environment, that's not really a true statement. I think Windows machines are still much more vulnerable. I mean, one of the first things I do anytime I set up a new Windows machine, you know, even before I connect to the internet, I'm putting an antivirus on it because I'm just like, this machine's going to be hammered. Based on the way the Macs are structured, I don't necessarily have that fear so much. And I feel like if I'm up to date with everything, I'm in pretty good shape. Now, I think it's probably being a good citizen. I think it's not going to hurt to run antivirus on the Mac. And maybe it's a good thing, especially if you're in a blended environment, because if you are going between Windows and Macs, you know, if you're using Dropbox on both, you know, maybe you save something from the Mac that actually had a Windows virus, and then you open it up in your Windows machine and, you know, it takes off and runs. So I'm not opposed to it, but I don't think the fear level's there yet. I'm not willing to say yet that Macs are as vulnerable as Windows to these types of things.
I think one example you can look at is how many people do you know that had a Windows machine and a serious malware outbreak on that machine in which they had to wipe and reinstall the operating system? I know many people have had to do that. Now, put that in the Mac world. How many people that have a Mac have had a virus problem so bad they had to wipe and reinstall their machine? And so far, I haven't found anybody who's had to do that yet. Now, that's not a great reliable metric. And because you don't have to wipe Windows machines as once you did have to do, it's probably less common. But you just don't see that yet in the Mac space.
I think the key word there is yet. So I think it's coming.
That's why I added it.
Okay, well, I guess we're done with that one. So that will conclude the podcast. I wanted to thank the host, Keith Watson, George Bailey, and Mike Hill, as well as Sirius. I'm Preston Wiley. Have a safe and secure day.